taking stock.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Andy Johnston. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Coming up, are supermarkets ripping Irish consumers off compared to our European counterparts? From rising fuel costs to higher wage demands, is now the time for the ECB to tackle the cost of living? And vive la France, while Brexit's Michel Barnier is shaping up to take on Emmanuel Macron in the French presidential elections. But first up, the profit margins of Irish supermarkets have always been classed as top secret. It's caused many to wonder, are Irish consumers being ripped off in comparison to the UK shoppers? But for the first time in the recent history, one of the Irish operators has in fact revealed their profit margins. Here to discuss the issue, we're joined now by Mark Paul, who is Business Affairs Correspondent at the Irish Times, and he's been examining this issue. Mark, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Mandy. How are you?
Very good. Mark, before we get stuck into the profits, can you just talk us through who the main players are in this retail space and tell us what they actually do publish?
Well, the three biggest operators are Dunnes Stores, Tesco and SuperValu, and they all have in or around the same, around about 22% of the market each. And then two German discount operators, Aldi and Lidl, between them have just over a quarter between them. Now, they're sort of the Johnny-come-latelys of the market. They joined around about 22 years ago, 23 years ago, they came into the market. And so they are the two 20-year-old ups starts, if you like. And there's not an awful lot of financial information goes around the Irish grocery sector. None of the Irish supermarket chains until now has ever reported its profits. Dunnes Stores is one of the most secretive companies in the state. It never reports any finances. Tesco does report its Irish sales, but not its profits. And Musgrave reports, as a group, reports its sales and profits, but it doesn't break SuperValu out of that. It's mixed up with its wholesale business and with its sort of retail brands, Centra and so on. And Aldi and Lidl have never, Lidl has never traditionally reported profits, and neither has Aldi. Marks and Spencer's has never broken out its Irish grocery results. And the first now to put its head above the parapet is Aldi Ireland, which has revealed for the first time its Irish financial performance. And that gives a window into the market.
Yeah, and we'll come back to why exactly they're doing that now. But could you just tell me, Mark, why do you think Irish supermarkets are so reticent to discuss their financial performance? And does anyone care? Would it affect Irish consumers if they knew who was making profit and who was making the most profit?
Well, I think that the reason that they don't do it now is different to the reasons that they didn't report their profits before. I think the reason that they don't do it now is because it's just become the way things are done in the Irish market. But the reason that they didn't do it before was, or certainly the suspicions were, in the sort of really frothy Celtic Tiger years, that foreign-based supermarkets, the likes of Tesco and so on, that they were doing particularly so well in the Irish market that they didn't want to break out the profits because people would see, that really Irish consumers were much more profitable for them than their consumers elsewhere. I mean, it wasn't for nothing that the foreign supermarket chains used to call Ireland Treasure Island, and because the suspicion was really that they were, really drilling people here for profits. But I think a culture just developed in the sector over the years. I mean, Dunnes Stores and they were all afraid to be first to jump, but now Aldi has jumped in feet first.
I'm always a little bit suspicious of converts to transparency. What prompted this from Aldi, and just how well is that retailer doing here in Ireland?
Well, look, they didn't do it out of the goodness of their heart, Mandy. Let's put it that way. But it's all down to Brexit, basically. And it's an obscure accounting rule. That means in the past, Aldi has always wrapped its Irish results up with its British results and reported them as a kind of a job lot. And Aldi Ireland's operation here, it has 149 stores here, it has its own managing director and 4,600 staff, but it's effectively controlled from Britain. And there's an accounting rule that says, if your company, you don't have to file accounts in Ireland as long as your headquarters is controlled from somewhere within the EU. And of course, Brexit happened and the transition period ran out. And as a result of that, Aldi Ireland's headquarters effectively is controlled from outside of the European Union in Britain. And so they've had to file Irish accounts for the first time. And what it shows is that the accounts that they filed are for 2020, last year. That's the first ones they filed. But they've also disclosed the figures for 2019 to give us a comparison. And what they show is that in 2020, which includes the first 10 months of the pandemic, their profits were up 46%. Aldi Ireland have basically 2 billion euros in sales in the Irish market. Over the course of 2020, their sales grew by 14%, which is actually slightly behind the market. I mean, the market went completely bonkers in 2020. I don't know about you, Manny, but I was in and out of the supermarkets more times in last year than I had ever been, because there was nowhere else to go, and there was no bars, no restaurants to go to. We were all eating, drinking so much at home. And so the grocery sector really exploded. And Aldi, you know, we're just behind the market growth, but where they are doing pretty well is in the level of profits they're taking out of the Irish market. When you measure it as a percentage of sales, Aldi's stores in Ireland are 70% more profitable than their stores in the UK. Those are the figures from 2020.
That figure really stood out for me, Mark. Why is that? I know you referred to Ireland as Treasure Island before in this retail space, but exactly why is that? Why is it so much more here than it is perhaps in the UK?
Well, I can tell you what Aldi's managing director, Niall O'Connor, told me when he revealed the numbers to me. The Irish profit margin is 3.6%, right? Which actually isn't a huge profit margin in the grand scheme of things. But the profit margin in the UK is only 2.1%. Now, these German multiples like Aldi and Lidl, they operate on really wafer-thin margins. And the reason he said that the Irish operation was so much more profitable as a percentage of sales was because, for two reasons. Number one, he said the UK is more competitive. It's a much bigger market with much bigger players, and competition is much more aggressive and fierce over there. So that has an impact on prices. And the other reason that he gave was that he said the Irish operation, because it's so inextricably bound up with the British operation, they sort of piggyback on it. They sort of come in on its coattails with some of their costs. Like, for example, you know, their app, their technology stuff is designed in the UK by the UK's technology team. There's no reason in the world, he says, for them to have two big IT teams. So they piggyback on stuff like that, so they can keep their costs lower by siphoning off by basically using some of the functions in the UK. And he says it's more competitive over there, and that's why. Now, look, there might be other factors in there as well. I mean, Irish consumers, you know, I mean, they can be pretty fluhulock with their money. And in recent years in particular, they've shown, Irish consumers in the grocery sector have shown a real willingness to spend on premium products and to spend on brands. So, look, I'd imagine it's a little bit of all of those factors mashed in together.
That makes sense that, you know, they don't have new standalone costs in Ireland for HQ and things, and they can piggyback on that. But given the amount of sales, and just sticking with Aldi on its own for a second, have they intentions to reinvest back into Ireland? Are they going to expand here? Will our producers benefit? What's next for them?
Yeah, they do have plans to expand. I mean, they've got 149 stores already. They've previously indicated that they'd like to get that up to about 200, but they've set out plans to invest 320 million euros over the next 3 years in another around about 30 stores. Now, really, where Aldi really need to invest is in the Dublin market. I mean, in the words of Niall O'Connor, Aldi Ireland's managing director, they were outgunned in Dublin in the pandemic by the bigger operators because they don't have as big of a footprint. And, you know, when the market went bonkers last year and we were all shopping like crazy, the Dublin market really was the place to be because that's where people had the most money and the most disposable income. And Aldi's footprint in Dublin is actually fairly puny in relative terms. It's much stronger down the country, and there's a solid reason for that. It's really, really, really hard to get the big sites that it needs, these big greenfield sites in Dublin. I mean, you know, it doesn't do a kind of a high street operation, you know, like an Aldi Express or something.
They're on the outskirts of towns. They need a large area. They have a big footprint. So, yeah, you can understand why rural settings would be, you know, easier for them. If you've just joined us, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. We're talking to Mark Paul, who's business affairs correspondent at the Irish Times. Mark, can you just go back to that thing you mentioned earlier, the Brexit bonus, if there's any at all. Maybe it'll deliver some transparency into reporting from the retailers in Ireland, because that legislative amendment means that companies in Ireland whose effective head office is registered outside of the European Union have to reveal their results. But will that drive transparency for the indigenous and domestic retailers?
I'll tell you who it could potentially affect, and that's Tesco and Marks and Spencers. It's not going to affect Dunn Stores. Dunn Stores is an Irish company. It's an unlimited company. They won't have to file accounts. It's not going to affect Lidl, Aldi's compatriot, because Lidl's Irish numbers are wrapped up in a German company, and Germany, of course, is in the European Union, so they don't have to. It's not going to affect Supervalu because they're part of an Irish company already. So that leaves Tesco and M&S. Now, M&S only have a couple of percent of the market. They're pretty small. So the real interesting thing to see will be how profitable is Tesco's Irish operation, and how profitable is it in comparison to its stores in the UK. Now, Tesco at a corporate level, at a head office level, has really, really strong Irish links. I mean, Ken Murphy, its chief executive, is an Irish guy. He's from Cork, I think. So there has always been questions asked of Tesco when it was the king of the Irish market at the height of the Celtic Tiger. There was accusations, I suppose, slung its way, which Tesco always denied, but that they were really, you know, that they were really dragging a lot of profits out of Irish consumers. It'll be interesting to see what they are now. I mean, if you look at Aldi's profits, 3.6% right now. Let's assume that Tesco is in or around that kind of a ballpark. Before Aldi and Lidl arrived in the market just over 20 years ago, the average Irish supermarket made about 6% in the kind of Treasure Island days. Now, that would have been fairly stratospheric for that sector.
Yeah, you referred to Aldi and Lidl earlier as game changers, and certainly their introduction, to my mind, is comparable to Ryanair in terms of closing the monopolies down on the Irish market. How significant do you think their introduction has been to that changing space?
They have, it's my opinion, but I think a lot of people share this opinion, that they have completely and utterly changed the market in a way far beyond their market share. I mean, between them, they've got a quarter of the market, which isn't bad over 20 years from a standing start, but they've completely forced all of your operators, Tesco, Supervalu and Dunn's, to change their models. And they've done that with this relentless focus on price. I've spent a little bit of time behind the scenes looking at the operating models of both Aldi and Lidl. And it's all about small little details, a little bit like you mentioned Ryanair. It's the same kind of thing. I mean, for example, before they arrived, you know, all Irish supermarkets would have employed people to stack the shelves. It's a big labour cost. And what Aldi and Lidl do is they get all of their products delivered on big sort of boxes and trays that you can just wheel out and throw onto the shelf in 2 seconds in the box. You don't take it out of a box and put it directly onto the shelf. You put the whole box onto the shelf. Now, that sounds like a minuscule change, but if you're stacking your shelves a couple of times a day and you can do it in 1/5 or 1/4 of the time, that adds up in labor costs. Another thing is that you often see with their own brand products in Aldi and Lidl, let's say if it's a box of tea bags, there'll often be 4 or 5 different barcodes on the box of tea bags. And the reason for that is that the person scanning them at the till doesn't have to twist it around several times looking for it. There's always a barcode ready. You scan it and you lash it through. All of these little things add up. They're pretty. One thing you would think that companies like this that are so relentless on costs that they would be really heavy on their labour costs, but actually they pay more than most other supermarket groups.
Really, that's very interesting. Could you expand on that a little bit?
They do. Now, I don't. They pay. Look, in or around the starting per hour would be in or around 12 or 13 euro per hour in both of them. But I mean, at a very, very young age, people can work their way up to management level at Aldi and Lidl and you know, become area managers on like 90, 95 grand with an Audi car. And to do that before the age of 30 or 32, I mean, there's real career prospects there. They pay their staff very well. They look after them very well. And they're all very young. And one thing that I noticed actually a couple of years ago, now the company has always played this down, but if you look at Aldi's middle management structure, if you try and trace it through LinkedIn or somewhere, there's an awful lot of ex-army officers, ex-Irish army officers, who work for Aldi, because you do your 20 years in the army, and you're entitled to leave the army then with your pension and so on. You might be, you know, you might be 40 years of age,
or still young enough, you can start something else.
Exactly. And Aldi has snapped up an awful lot of ex-Irish army officers because I suppose they're very process-driven people. They're people who are used to working in a routine, logistics. And it's very, very interesting. Now, they've always played that down, but I mean, the evidence is there when you look at its management structure.
Mark, just at the outset, I asked you, why is there a lack of transparency on the reporting front? And you said it's the way that it always was. So it's that culture of, I suppose, secrecy, for want of a better word. Do you think that this is going to change now? It'll change the culture? It'll prompt more people to move forward or reveal what their profits are?
Well, look, if Tesco go ahead and do it, and between Tesco and Aldi, you'll have about 36, 37% of the market. So well over a third of the market will be doing it already. I don't think Dunn's Stores are ever going to do it. It is just not the
not
way
the culture.
Margaret Heffernan. Yeah. It's just not the culture. And I don't think Lidl will do it because they don't have to, and Super Value don't have to do it. So look, what you might find is that Aldi and Tesco, if they have to do it, will use the fact that they reveal their Irish profits to try and communicate to Irish customers that, look, we're really transparent. We tell you how much money they make. They might try and make some marketing hay out of it. And maybe then you'll get a reaction. But look, I would imagine that there's probably not an awful lot in terms of profitability between all of the various operators. From all these figures, we should be able to sit down now because we know what the total market is worth and we know how what slice it has and we know how profitable it is. We should be able to sit down on a back of the envelope kind of a thing and work out how profitable the others are. I don't think there'd be any huge surprises in it. But I mean, the level of competition, the secrecy in the market operationally, and the competition between them for senior executives, all of that is going to go on. And look, ultimately, in a way, that's good for Irish consumers. I mean, there's been very, very little inflation in the grocery market over the last 20 years since the two German companies joined. There has been tension in the market with farmers and with suppliers, not just with Aldi and Lidl, but with the fact that groceries are so cheap in Ireland. I mean, you can buy, you know, I mean, there's, for example, you can find promotions in some of the supermarkets where you can buy, you know, six different types of veg for just a couple of euro. And those things have always caused tension. So look, there's still a lot to go in the Irish market. There's also another thing with the Irish market is that we're not very big here on online grocery shopping, which has always been surprising to me because Ireland is a fairly tech savvy country, right? I mean, we all have smartphones. There's pretty good broadband coverage. We're a tech hub for Europe. Yet, only about 4% of Irish grocery sales, even after the pandemic.
Yeah,
only
I was very surprised at those figures. Maybe it is that social side of shopping, I don't know, that you mentioned at the beginning, that Irish people like in a way that other countries don't.
It's a little bit of that, yeah. I mean, look, maybe we've just all become saddles because we don't go to the pubs and restaurants as much and we go to supermarkets now for fun. But there is a social element to Irish shopping. And you're right, there is and you know, it's getting out there and sort of, you know, squeezing the slice pan and all of that to see is it fresh. But there's also some more mundane corporate reasons for it as well. One is that most supermarkets lose money on online shopping on the delivery aspect of it. I mean, Aldi subcontracts it out to Deliveroo.
That's the one question I want to ask you. So why is the delivery part of Aldi and Lidl so weak? You know, they don't seem to invest in that. Is it because the transport cost is too much? Does it not give the return?
It's because they would have to subsidize it.
Yeah.
And they would have to subsidize it because in order to charge what you would have to charge for online delivery to wash its face by itself, they think it would be just too much of an additional price for their customers to pay. So if they were to keep that price down to where it needs to be, they would have to suck, you know, profits from the rest of the business to subsidize it. And the reason why they would have to subsidize it is because Ireland is you know, we've only got 5 million people in the market
small
in
market,
the Republic.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is dispersed over wide rural areas. And Aldi in particular, I mean, it's very strong down the country, but I mean, you know, there could be, you know, 20 miles, 30 miles between its shops. So it's just not economic for them. Whereas in the UK, I mean, there's, you know, a much bigger market plowed onto a fairly small piece of land. And it's much more economic to do it over there. But look, online will eventually grow because customers will demand it. It's just a case of how much it will cost and how much supermarkets will have to subsidise it going into the long term.
Okay, well, despite the lack of transparency, we do have to acknowledge that they employ thousands of people and they keep Irish suppliers going, and they were a lifeline to us all during COVID-19, particularly the home delivery service, which was hugely important to many people who couldn't leave their homes. Mark, thank you very much for joining us today. That's Mark Paul, Business Affairs Correspondent at the Irish Times.
You're welcome, Mandy. Thanks.
Now, Now, the French presidential elections will take place in April of next year, and new challengers are emerging in the background and causing major disruption to the opinion polls. This election comes at a time when France increasingly finds its place in the world unsettled by geopolitical developments all around it. And we're joined now from Paris by journalist Victor Mallet of the Financial Times, who is the Paris bureau chief there. Victor, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Victor, now, we obviously invited you here today to talk about the elections and the French political landscape, but obviously on Wednesday there was that desperate tragedy where during an attempt to cross the English Channel from France, a number of people died, including some women and some children. And it has been a desperate human tragedy, of course, but it's also further frayed relations between the French and British authorities. Now, you've been covering this and it's a desperately sad situation and all too familiar an incident, but do you think it's enough to prompt a serious attempt by French, UK and EU authorities to finally tackle this problem together for once and for all?
I think it might. I noticed that in the week before this tragedy happened, the two sides had actually been slightly less abusive of each other. You know, both French and British ministers and leaders had been a little bit more polite. They'd been trying to sort of cool down the tensions, which had really been going on for quite a long time after Brexit. And I think one reason for that is that everybody realized that this isn't really about Brexit. Although, of course, it's worsened by the disputes over Brexit, over fish and over Northern Ireland and so on. But I think the tragedy may hopefully galvanize the two sides into actually trying to find a solution in cooperation with each other.
And we'll come back to those relationships in a few moments, Victor. But if we can just move on to the elections and the more general landscape in France. And before we talk about the other contenders, we might just examine a little bit the role of Macron. How will his presidency be viewed, as presumably he seeks to get re-elected? Has he changed France for the better? And is he a popular leader there?
It's very hard to say. The opinion polls show that he is the most popular of the would-be candidates, because not everyone has declared. Macron himself has not declared. There are a lot of people in Paris in particular, I think, and even outside, who say they hate him. But that is quite common for a French president at this stage in his or her mandate. There haven't been any women presidents yet, to be hated by people. It's a very kind of confrontational political scene. But I think, on the whole, people think he's managed the COVID pandemic pretty well, certainly as well as most of his neighbours. And if there's disappointment on the right and the centre-right, it's really because he hasn't been able to push through a lot of the economic reforms that he promised. On the other hand, he has done quite a few. He's kind of eased up the labour market and that has started to produce results. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. But given the records of his predecessors, he's actually not that unpopular. And he is, in fact, the leading candidate in the polls at the moment for the election in April.
Yeah, when you compare him to Hollande and Sarkozy, they were probably in a similar situation going into to their second elections. I'm interested in something that you said there about he's perceived to have handled the pandemic well, because there has been quite a lot of protest in France about the COVID-19 situation, particularly the anti-vax movement. It's quite dominant over there. It's been quite aggressive.
Well, actually, funnily enough, before the pandemic, there was, and you know, right at the beginning, there was a very high degree of vaccine skepticism in France. In fact, it was one of the most vaccine skeptical countries in the world. Something like, you know, approaching half of people who are questioned said they were sort of opposed or suspicious of vaccines. But actually, when the pandemic hit, and particularly in July, when Macron said in order to get into a restaurant or to go on a train journey or a plane journey, you would need to have your health pass, which would have to basically include a vaccine. In fact, it turned out that a lot of the anti-vaxxers were not really very committed anti-vaxxers. And something like 9/10 of the French people eligible have actually had a vaccination now. Where there has been real sort of protests and violence is actually in Guadeloupe and Martinique in the Caribbean, which are French territories in the Caribbean. There is much greater real suspicion of vaccines. And there were protests against the fact that health workers, for example, and fire farmmen and farwomen were supposed to, well, were obliged to have the vaccine. So, but in France itself, I mean, given the degree of regular protests we have about everything in Paris every weekend, it hasn't actually been that bad.
When you look at the general landscape there in the run-up to the election campaign, and although he hasn't declared, the right, it seems, is becoming quite a heavily populated space in the French discourse, isn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, the new kid on the block is this polemical journalist called Eric Zemmour, who sort of rose to prominence on the back of a talk show as a very right-wing commentator. Anti-migration, you know, believes in the great replacement theory, which says that we're all going to be overwhelmed by Muslim migrants in the coming decades. And he is really shaken things up because he wasn't anywhere on the scene about 3 or 4 months ago. And he's gone right up in the polls. And at one point, and in fact, even now, he's second or perhaps third in the polls behind Macron. And he's challenging Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, the traditional far-right leader who's been around for a long time. She and her father run something called the Rassemblement National, which used to be the National Front, the Front National. And they are now sort of neck and neck in the polls, these two very far-right parties. And it's true that the electorate as a whole is pretty much on the right at the moment, and the left is not really very visible.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. We're talking to Victor Mallet, who's Paris correspondent with the Financial Times. Yeah, he's a very divisive character, isn't he? Straight out of the Donald Trump playbook, it seemed, appealing to people's emotions rather than moving on a platform of policy. But if there was a split in the far right, would that be good for Macron?
Well, there is a split in the far right in the sense that, you know, there's him and her, there's Zemmour and Le Pen, and he's definitely taken votes from her, or potential votes from her. He's also taken potential votes from the centre-right, who have sort of opted for Zemmour, even though he's more extreme-right than Le Pen is. He's sort of seen by the intelligentsia and the kind of traditional conservative centre-right as more acceptable because he's more intellectual. He's a kind of, you know, he's a writer, so he seems more okay than a kind of working class champion like Marine Le Pen. And it's quite peculiar in that sense. But possibly, it's very hard to say at this stage, and we always get surprises in French elections, but it possibly could be bad for Macron, actually, because it could mean that in the second round, the sort of second and final round of the elections in France, the way it works here is you have a two-round system. He could end up facing a centre-right candidate like Xavier Bertrand or Valérie Pécresse or Michel Barnier, the former Brexit negotiator, instead of Le Pen or Zemmour, because you basically narrow it down to the last two. And if that is the case, then funnily enough, it might be more difficult for Macron because he's more similar and his policies are more similar to those of the centre-right. So if he faced a centre-right candidate, it would be tougher for him to differentiate himself against that rival.
That's very interesting. Another entrant to the race is somebody who we were very familiar with here in Ireland because of his role on the Brexit negotiations, is Michel Barnier, who's seeking to become a candidate for his own party. Could you just talk to me about what his chances are within the party and how you think he might fare?
Yeah, we won't know until the 4th of December. When he first put in his potential candidacy, and of course he has to be chosen by his party, Les Républicains, when he first put in, people didn't give him much chance because he was quite low in the polls. He had been a politician in France, but nobody really knew much about him. He was better known in Britain, actually, than he was in France at that point. But he's kind of steadily won support from a lot of party members, and they're the ones who vote in this, what is essentially a primary election restricted to party members, by being loyal to the party. He didn't leave the party in a huff like some of the others did. So he has actually a chance. What we don't know is a lot of new members have been persuaded to join by the various candidates in the party. And we don't know how many of them are going to vote for Barnier and how many of them are going to vote for the others. So it's a little bit hard to say. But he certainly has a fighting chance of being the candidate and therefore being the person who is very likely to stand against Macron.
He's taken quite, Barnier now I'm talking about, has taken quite aggressive lines on immigration and judicial sovereignty. It surprised a few people. Could you just talk to us a little bit about that?
I think that's kind of what you were referring to earlier about the way the whole sort of landscape has shifted to the right. Mm-hmm. All the candidates of the centre-right have taken quite far-right-ish policies and adopted them, including on migration, where Barnier, for example, is calling for a moratorium of 3 to 5 years on migration. And he's also taken this kind of right-wing nationalist sovereigntist view that European law should not have primacy over French law, particularly on matters of immigration. So he has moved to the right, but then so have all the others.
Now, in the post-Brexit, post-Merkel landscape, France finds itself increasingly thrown, in my view, by the geopolitical winds of change. We saw that in recent months the rather public row now dubbed as the AUKUS dispute over that large submarine contract. And whilst the sums involved were vast, maybe far more damaging was their political reputation or embarrassment on the world stage. Do you feel that that's something that still resonates in France, or is that something that, you know, the politicians care about, but people won't?
I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, I think this is not something that's going to have a big role in domestic politics. You know, Macron, as the president of France, does do all the foreign policy, essentially. And this was a blow to him. But I don't think it's going to have much impact on the election at this stage, especially since, you know, there was a sort of moment of humiliation and angst. But basically, the bridges have been rebuilt with the Americans and will eventually probably be rebuilt with the Australians, although that's not happening yet. But and the relationship between France and Britain was already very shaky because of sort of mutual abuse over everything from fish to the consequences of Brexit.
Yeah, as you've identified earlier, in these primary stages of an election, the politicians can have a very different agenda to what the electorate actually care about. So just facing into the election in 2022, what are the key items for the French electorate as opposed to the French politicians?
Well, yeah, we were talking earlier about Eric Zemmour on the far right and Marine Le Pen. And unfortunately, migration and law and order are going to be very big themes in this election. Because that is, you know, what everybody is talking about. You mentioned that Zemmour was a kind of Trump-like, and he is. He's a genius for that kind of thing that attracts public attention. Whether you love it or hate it, you talk about it. You know, for example, Zemmour said we should ban foreign names like Mohammed and Kevin. You know, go figure. I think, is Kevin an Irish name? I think it might be originally. But anyway, obviously this, you know, was very unpopular with people called Kevin and Mohammed. Very popular with people who dislike Muslims, but it doesn't matter how absurd it is. The point is, it got him talked about. So people are talking about issues of migration. They are talking about law and order. There's not that much talk about the economy. I think partly because it's sort of, obviously it took a hit in COVID, but it's come back, and the French have, again, they've done as well as or better than some of their European neighbours. Unemployment is sort of back down to the levels it was before the crisis. So, yeah, I think, unfortunately, migration is going to be a big issue in this election.
Well, Victor, thank you very much for your insights today, which are fascinating, as always, in my view. I hope that you'll be able to join us again, maybe nearer to the election, to give us more predictions that we can hold you to. And I don't know what somebody called Kevin did to Mr. Zemmour, but we'll watch this space with interest. Victor Mallet of the Financial Times, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Mandy Johnston with you on News Talk's Taking Stock. Now, the global inflation that's happening right now is a consequence of a really strong rebound in demand set against a shortage of supply on many, many goods. What started out as a niche concern at the beginning of 2021 is now the main economic issue that's consuming most governments around the world. We're joined now by Oana Pei, who is Assistant Professor at the School of Economics at University College Dublin, to examine this issue. Oana, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us on News Talk today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Oana, we heard earlier in this week the Irish Central Bank governor talk about inflation and its impact on Irish households. He said he was very, very concerned, but that patience was the right response right now. To start us off, could you just take us through some of the things that are driving inflation at the moment?
So This is the largest annual change in prices we have seen in Ireland since April 2007. Inflation rates stand at around 5%, and the main factor behind it is a so-called cost push or supply side shock, which is mainly the result of a global rise in fuel and energy prices, but also supply bottlenecks due to the pandemic, which caused some firms to experience shortages of inputs and raw materials or shipping delays. So more precisely, the biggest contribution to this increase in the consumer price index last month came from the transport sector, where car fuel prices increased by 23%, motor car prices were up by around 8%, and airline ticket prices also saw significant price jumps. Higher rents, but also higher costs of home heating, electricity, and gas also explain about 11% of the overall increase in the consumer price index. But there are also sectors where prices have decreased, such as clothing and footwear, for example, which saw a price decrease of around 2.4%. Euro area inflation is at around 4.1%, and it's largely driven by the same cost push or supply side factors.
Oh, and could I just come in there and ask you, as just as the trends are not unique to Ireland, so too the solutions are not unique to Ireland. Can you just talk us through what mechanics governments have, what mechanisms governments and central banks around the world have to try and counteract these inflation rises?
The main policy tool is monetary policy. So central banks aim to keep inflation stable and prices stable. So the ECB's monetary policy options going forward will largely depend on whether the increase in prices that we have seen over the last couple of months is a temporary one or a longer term. So the ECB forecast, for example, puts average inflation at 2.2% in 2021, peaking in the last quarter of this year, followed by a fall to 1.7% in 2022 and 1.5% in 2023. And this is because, mainly because it expects the supply bottlenecks to ease and energy prices to drop. And we have seen the first signs of that in the future markets for natural gas prices, for example.
But we've also seen a growing expectation that they will use interest rate rises to deal with this issue. Could you talk us through what is expected there from the US and across Europe?
So the main policy tool that the ECB can use at this point is to increase interest rates and decrease its asset purchase program. And this, as I said, largely depends on whether the inflation rates that we are seeing are transitory or not. But you have to keep in mind that inflation has been persistently below the target for much of the time since the global financial crisis, despite monetary policy in euro area and in the US being very expansionary throughout this period.
So I was listening to your colleague, Carl Whelan from UCD last week, was speaking to the Oireachtas Committee. And one of the other tools that was suggested to deal with the inflation issues in Ireland, particularly on the energy prices, was the issue of VAT reduction. And he said that he was glad that the government hadn't reduced VAT rates in Ireland in the budget or even given things like restaurant vouchers out to households to deal with the pandemic, because he felt that they could fan the flames of what is already a really uncomfortably high level of inflation. What's your take on that?
I agree. So while the main causes of the high inflation we have seen over the last couple of months are externally driven, further fiscal stimulus, such as reducing VAT rates or restaurant voucher, would cause prices to rise even further through a demand side channel. So we already seen, for example, prices in the restaurants and hotel sectors have increased on average by 4.1% as compared to last year. So measures such as restaurant vouchers, which only create excess demand, would push prices even higher.
So driving down demand is quite a tricky business. Increasing interest rates is a tricky and delicate situation for governments. They have to be really careful that they don't do something else like spark a rise in wage demands, for example.
That's true. I think central banks are now facing a very difficult trade-off between the cost of tightening monetary policy, so rising interest rates prematurely, which will weaken the recovery from the pandemic recession, and the costs of inflation. So inflation dynamics in the near future are mainly driven by the supply side, which is energy prices. The central bank should hold off in rising interest rates, which can hurt the economic recovery. If we see inflation expectations spiral and wage increases as well, then the future cost of inflation might rise significantly. So an increase in interest rates might happen sooner than we expect right now.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston. We're talking to Ona Paya, who is Assistant Professor at the School of Economics at University College Dublin. Ona, could I just ask you about the mortgage holders in this scenario? If interest rates increase as they are expected to, what will that mean for mortgage holders and for indeed for people who are trying to get on the property ladder and get mortgages now?
Well, increases in interest rates, as most mortgage holders will have a variable interest rate, will affect them directly, right? Variable interest rates are just key policy rate plus a bank markup. Banks are not going to change their markup. So any increase in the key policy rate, so if the ECB increases interest rate, will translate to an increase in variable interest rates. And this will increase their interest burden. So this is going to be, it's going to have a very contractionary effect on the economy. That is why I think the ECB is being cautious. And I think their first response has been to wait and see whether the inflation rates that we are seeing are indeed transitory or not. If in the future, the main factor that is driving inflation is still a supply side, so it's mainly energy prices, then we expect that this should lessen in the future. However, a concern happens when other factors come into play, such as a change in inflation expectations or a change in wages, which is driven by inflation expectations. And when this happens, we could see an inflationary spiral and hence an increase in interest rates.
Just looking at the longer term picture, some have been critical of the role of central banks and the ECB in terms of interest rates and that they've allowed long term low interest rates to dominate for far too long and that now we just all expect it.
Well, the reason why interest rates have been so low for such a long time is that before the pandemic and for much of the period since 2008, inflation had been stubbornly low and economic growth very weak. Right, the Fed had already started increasing interest rates in 2017 when the U.S. inflation started to pick up, but in the euro area, inflation has been persistently below the 2% target. So the risk of interest rates being too low for a long period is first that they fuel a credit-driven boom, which is what we have seen in Ireland prior to 2008. But this has not been the case so far. The other risk is, of course, high inflation. But as I mentioned earlier, the inflation we see today is not primarily demand-driven, but supply-driven. So I believe that credible central banks could rein in further increases in inflation should they occur by tightening monetary policy in the future. But this, as I mentioned, comes at a cost of weakening the recovery from the pandemic recession. So acting too soon in raising interest rates might be very costly in terms of output losses.
Yeah, if you just look at the US and the divergence between their interest rates and their inflation rates at 6% now, it's not an ideal scenario when you'd be expecting those to be much more aligned with each other. Can I just, Ona, for a second, look at a different side of the Irish economy, if I could? The investment activities of multinationals have contributed significantly to the Irish tax take. It's, in fact, what keeps us so buoyant. Do you think that the trend of the take that we have from multinational companies will continue next year in 2022? And how do you think the corporation tax changes that were recently announced affect Ireland's relationship with multinationals going forward?
Yeah, so investment by firms tends to be very volatile when the economy faces huge uncertainty. And this is what we have seen over the past 2 years. So it's unlikely that the recent tax changes are an important driver of what is happening right now with the volatility of investment. But going forward, I think most evidence seems to suggest that Ireland will remain in a strong position to attract foreign direct investment. I think investing in higher education to ensure that foreign firms have a great pool of talent here in Ireland, or reforms, ease of doing business reforms, are more likely to matter more than the tax rate, which stood at 12.5%, which many big tech firms actually never paid in the first place.
I'll just ask one final question, if I may, and it's about the thing that economists like to do most, make some predictions. Could you tell us what you think is going to happen on the inflationary front in the short to medium term and how the ECB and other central banks will react in terms of rate increases?
I think there's considerable uncertainty around the inflation outlook. And there are definitely many market participants who believe that the ECB is underestimating inflationary pressures and will likely have to announce an increase in interest rates before the start of 2023. But we have to keep in mind, as I said, that inflation has been persistently low. And the ECB now targets an inflation rate of 2% over the medium run. And this is important because it suggests that a rate of inflation of 4% that we see today might not be above this target of 2% over the medium run. So I think the ECB has more room to postpone interest rate increases and would not be the first one to move to increase interest rates. What we have to pay attention at the next meeting on December 16 is what is happening to their asset purchase programs. So the ECB is expected to wind down the pandemic emergency purchase program at this meeting, but still continue to buy bonds under its regular asset purchase program.
Okay, we leave it there. It's looking far less likely that the growth in inflation is a transitory thing, and perhaps it is something more permanent that policymakers will need to deal with in the future as well. That's Oana Paya, Assistant Professor at the School of Economics at University College Dublin. Oana, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Now, while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're also available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. We've got a bit more time in the podcast, so there are extended conversations with our guests today. For now, though, I'd like to thank the production team of Simon Keane and Ronan Coveney with Jojo Cardozo on sound. Jonathan McRae is up next with Future Proof, and then it's Gavin Riley with On The Record. So from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, enjoy the rest of your day.